Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. Today, we're talking to Eric Lefkofsky, CEO of Tempus AI and a great operator kind of in the startup scene for a long time. Eric, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Eric, can you start out and let us know what is Tempus AI? Why did you start it? You went from, I guess most notably from a public perspective, being in the Groupon circle to suddenly running an AI healthcare tech startup. This seems like a strange move, and it's a very successful and growing franchise. So, what led to this moment?
So, in my case, I've been in tech for a long time. I got into technology in 1999 and had built a series of technology companies, all kind of interestingly applying technology to spaces that historically didn't have a lot of technology. It's just the way the career kind of went. We started applying technology to the printing industry and then transportation and logistics, literally, moving trucks around, and then media buying. And these spaces were all kind of very antiquated and had not adopted technology. And we had developed some expertise at building these kind of hybrid systems that were like half human, half automated, and made these marketplaces more efficient. And those companies grew and they went public or got sold or whatever. And then when Groupon came around, it was a kind of a similar problem in that we were trying to apply technology, a different kind of technology, basically tipping point technology, to local businesses and local problems. And so I found myself, pretty early on leveraging a lot of those same skills that I had now developed over more than a decade. And, trying to figure out how do you bring technology to the hands of people that own a pizza parlor or a dry cleaner, right? I mean, very local folks that have not historically adopted technology. And I, from that point on, really never thought I would get into healthcare. But about 10 years ago, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so I found myself spending a lot of time in a clinic while I was, at this point, the CEO of Groupon. And I was just amazed at how little technology was a part of her care and how antiquated what, in theory, I would have thought was a very sophisticated process was from a technology and data and AI perspective. And so I think I just had this aha moment that my entire career and all these skills I had learned at applying technology to spaces that historically had not had technology was kind of meant for healthcare. And so I just had a big pivot. I figured since I had spent time learning other industries, I could learn this. Might take a long time, but I could learn it. And that's what I did. I began kind of immersing myself, in this case, in oncology. And have been immersed, ever since.
How long ago was that? What is the start point of Tempus? And then where is Tempus now? Because it's more than oncology, or at least it has ambitions to be more than oncology. What does that look like today?
The company was founded in August. This August will be 10 years. So whatever that is, August of 15, I think. And pretty early on, we started off, when I say trying to apply technology to a space that didn't have technology, it was actually a much narrower focus than that. It was really trying to figure out how to make next generation sequencing or these genomic tests intelligent by connecting them to the clinical data for the patient from they were ordered. One of my big kind of aha moments early on was my wife was being sequenced when she in the course of her treatment, and these tests would come back not knowing if she was male or female, not knowing, you know, anything about her, what drugs she had taken, whether she was eligible for these trials. And so it was like a remarkably non-personalized report for what at the time was like the state of the art of personalized medicine. And so I'm thinking, like, this is crazy. Why don't they know that she's a woman? Why don't they know what drugs she took? Why don't they know that she's not eligible for that trial? Like, they just didn't know those things. And so we set out to kind of connect those dots. And at the time, I really, having been in technology and starting Tempus as a tech company, I didn't think we would be sequencing patients. I assumed we would be building that intelligence layer that sat on top of other people's sequencing. And so I went to those folks who did the sequencing at the time and said, hey, I want to solve this problem. I'm pretty convinced this is the main problem, especially as these tests get more complicated and in multiple disease areas. So let me build that technology. But the challenge is no one would give us the molecular data so we could contextualize or make intelligent those reports. They refused. They refused to give it to us. They refused to give it back to the hospitals or doctors that were ordering these tests. They had it locked. And so that opened up a kind of a point for us to enter the market. We began sequencing, and we started in oncology, and obviously still have our biggest roots in oncology. But probably 5 or 6 years into Tempus, we realized that the platform we had built that makes these diagnostic tests intelligent and contextualizes them and makes them personal was equally applicable not just in cancer, but in cardiology, neurology, immunology. Like pick any disease where there's kind of a lot of different therapeutic pathways, and we can help physicians make data-driven decisions.
Really interested in that journey from technology through to bio. Have you, along the way, sort of reflected and thought, what is it that the bio industry generally could learn from more studying how tech is executed, and maybe vice versa, but certainly in that direction?
Everything. I mean, it even today, like, I get sent, you know, articles and people kind of talk about how, like, technologically sophisticated this space is because these are very technically sophisticated people, but they are technically sophisticated in a completely different discipline than the one at hand. So, and the challenge is, like, it's very hard to be a craftsman who, you know, can, like, make cars with your hands and then accept a world where you can 3D print a car. Like, it's just a very hard thing. And so there is an absolute kind of lack of a skill set for computational biologists and bioinformaticians and translational researchers and folks with PhDs and MDs to apply the, you know, cutting edge AI tools and techniques, especially those that are being used today for large language model building and the like. And I think the first step is appreciating that and being like, okay, I'm an expert here. I'm not an expert there. And so how do I find people that are and build those bridges, which is what Tempus does kind of for a living. But you do, you know, I always say to people, like, swim in your own lane. Like, I don't want software engineers pretending to be PhDs or MDs and vice versa. And one of the things that's magical about Tempus, we're now, once we close this acquisition, we'll be approaching 4,000 people. We have huge, you know, 300 PhDs and, you know, 1,000 software engineers and AI scientists and people that are supporting that. And so just a very large infrastructure of technology talent that all has to come together to solve these problems, because you need the expertise of people with a deep science and especially biology and chemistry background, but you need the expertise of people that can actually, that understand how foundation models work and how they can be, modified in an agentic environment.
So that point about how people swim in their own lane is interesting, because obviously we hear a lot about people building and trying to constantly make people more and more bilingual and able to talk each other's language. And there's obviously some merit in that. There's also merit in focus. And do you think then it is about a journey to make people more bilingual between the tech and the bio side? Or is it more about building high bandwidth ways that they can communicate and help each other out? And yeah, how does that journey look as we go forward and as you grow the company?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have long felt like it is going to take The journey, I think, candidly, and there's so many broken parts of the process. It's, you know, I've said this historically, like, if you had said to me 10 years ago, like, design a ecosystem that would impede progress at every turn, I would hand you the U.S. healthcare system. This is almost masterminded. Like, it's genius in its complexity to destroy progress, like, at every turn. Right. It's just, I mean, we could go on and on with, like, you, it's like a movie. So I don't think this process fixes itself from within. I just think it's set up to not do that. I think it's going to take, you know, private commercial enterprises that have a totally different incentive to solve this problem. And that's not good or bad. It's just a reality. You know, the incentives of the current system from an academic standpoint are often to publish and get grant money around a unique idea that you don't share too early. The incentives in terms of biopharma are typically to generate a drug that maximizes its value during its patent life. And the incentives of payers are complicated at best, what to pay for and when. That goes on and on. So if you look at the system today, it just isn't set up to adopt technology in big ways. And yet I think I'm quite sure the only solution to our problem, which at this point is maybe among the biggest problems facing the U.S. government, you can't support a $5 trillion healthcare spend that's growing at 7 or 8% a year. It's just, it'll engulf everything. The only solution to this problem is technology and AI. So I think it's going to take companies like Tempus that kind of have a clean slate, that have an appreciation for all the different constituents, but have a different economic model and one that is sustainable at scale to make enormous investments in deploying technology to really build products that help everybody be more efficient, including people that make drugs and people that treat patients and people that are treated by people that treat patients.
I'll hand the mic to Brett in a second, but I just wanted to say on that, there's a fantastic South Park episode I watched on the plane to the recent JP Morgan conference, The End of Obesity, which is essentially the mission that they have to try and get Cartman his Ozempic is only to just navigate the American healthcare system. Highly recommend a watch. It's lots of fun. And the segue I was going to give to Brett, because we just completed a piece of research which is going to go out in a few weeks, is that because of companies like Tempus and, you know, what you all are working on and lots of other great innovators in the space, we've done a fair amount of calculations saying that actually the tide has very much turned and really the ROI on the R&D going in to biopharma is very, very positive. Probably the first time in you know, many, perhaps decades. So I don't know if Brett was going to go there, but really interesting time for the industry at this point.
It's almost like these problems have existed for decades within the healthcare system. And we've also seen innovative companies kind of like throw themselves up against it and kind of get ground up by the friction. It's interesting to see here how you basically had to vertically integrate because nobody would let you in if you didn't. How do you think about like Tempus's kind of stance with regard to all of the skewed incentives that are in the whole ecosystem and how you've, I mean, so far successfully navigated that, I'd say, through the oncology channel, and then how you think about kind of like expanding the franchise, or you have, you know, a consumer facing or patient facing AI app now, which, you know, seems like obviously a useful thing to do, but not necessarily obviously something that becomes like a monetization engine for the company. So how do you think about kind of that strategic stance?
You start by saying like, okay, what am I trying to do here? Right? I'm trying to basically make diagnostics intelligent. Okay, so how do I make diagnostics intelligent? Well, the diagnostic has to know who the patient is and then recontextualize itself around that patient. And what diagnostics? Every diagnostic, right? Blood test, CAT scan, MRI, mammography, genomic test. I want every diagnostic input to be intelligent, contextualized. It's the only way to help physicians and patients get navigated to the right care, because diagnostics sit at the center of every major decision. Like, if you're ever sick, you would know this, like, no one makes a decision without ordering a myriad of tests and then interpreting that data and then setting you down a path. So we want that to be super intelligent. The problem with that is it's very expensive to kind of try to harmonize and normalize all healthcare data in the United States or in the world in real time and then deliver insights in real time. Like, that's no simple task. So our approach has always been to try to figure out how to build products that are sustainable as one individual puzzle piece in that bigger puzzle, right? And have them build on each other so that the puzzle becomes clear at some point. So we started with sequencing, saying, okay, can we build a, you know, good business in sequencing, one that grows and it delivers margin and cash flow and it's a good business? And then we're like, okay, if we can do that, and if that data is connected to clinical data, so we have like rich molecular data connected to outcome and response, who would find value in that data? Oh, biopharma. Okay, so how do we build products that biopharma wants that allows them to invest in these data sets so that that can help sustain this endeavor? And then you're like, okay, well, if I have those two going, then what's feeding that business? Well, what's feeding that is all this real-time connectivity of genomic data and clinical data that's kind of flowing in real time. And if I'm building these pipes to generate that, what other business can I layer on top? Can I help help patients get routed to the right clinical trial? Can I help close care gaps? Can I help say something algorithmically that I can get paid for? And each of these is like a puzzle piece that ultimately you hope, if you do it well, is generating lots of revenue, lots of gross profit, lots of free cash flow that can be contributed back into the whole. And probably, if I look at Tempus today, the two biggest hurdles that we've gotten over that it seems like others have not gotten over is, one, our broad connectivity, the fact that we have these connections to like 3,000 hospitals in the United States, right? It's a huge amount of the U.S. that is connected in this bi-directional way with Tempus. You know, we're sending us data, we're producing insights, we're putting them back in. The second is that we've been able to generate a business, and if you look at our guidance for next year, which I think is something like $1.23 billion, and cash flow EBITDA positive, you can do the math, like you're generating, I don't know, $800 million or something of gross profit. It's a tremendous amount of money if you follow those trends. And if you look at the amount of money we need to run the business, it's a minority of that gross profit, right? The majority of the gross profit dollars are being reinvested in product and engineering and science and studies and whatever. So we're at a point now where we're able to invest whatever, $500 million, $600 million, eventually $1 billion, like back into growth in a sustainable way. And if you look at the inflection point of like truly great businesses, and I hope Tempus is one of them, that math continues. So if you take a look at Google, if you just run that math forward for another 20 years, you know, if your business is growing at 25% a year for, you know, and you're at $1 billion of revenue for, you know, a decade or two, you're investing not $1 billion into new products, you're investing tens of billions or eventually $100 billion. And so if you want to know why search is so good, it's because Google probably invests 2x every year what we invest in the entire NIH budget on curing humans just in making search good. So it's really good. And people die. And we need to create a model that I think allows that same kind of a flywheel of investment.
You can imagine there's like various stages in this journey in which you could partner with others versus kind of like build it yourself, specifically on the AI side, as in, you know, I imagine your ambition is not to be like, I'm going to build a competitor to ChatGPT, but you do have a language model attached to the back end of your system, presumably powering the Olivia app. And there is reason to believe, I think, that kind of like injecting fundamental, at least like some of the clinical trial understanding into the language model in a fine-tuning manner, or maybe reinforcement learning, actually could enhance the set of answers that are provided on the back end of that. Where, like, to what degree does Tempus become defined by and driven on an R&D side by kind of like their ability to kind of develop specific AI systems versus kind of just connecting kind of like all of the rich biological information with AI backends?
We've always had a very large product engineering team and a team with deep AI expertise. I mean, we've been, it's just, if you look at our investments on an annual basis and the size of our investments since we've begun raising capital, this is where the majority of our money has gone. Like, it's just, we just spend a lot of money on tech. It's hundreds of millions a year. So it's no small endeavor, and it's been that way for a long time. And the vast majority of our technology stack today is proprietary code. I don't even know the total number, 70 million lines of code or some enormous amount of code. That said, we don't look to rebuild core underlying technologies that are kind of perfectly good and operating in what it feels like a commoditized manner, meaning multiple people have them, they're quite good. So like we didn't build our own optical character recognition system. We used one that was available at the time. And I think to some extent, I think of some of these large language models in that same vein where there are now multiple models, whether it's Gemini or Llama or Chat4 or whatever, you know, pick a model that operate really well, low cost, high fidelity. And so we spend more of our energy on building, it's a product we call Agent Builder, which now other people have similar products. But you know, we have, I don't even know the number, probably approaching 1,000 agents we built internally that are very good at taking these models and applying them toward multimodal healthcare data, which is radically different than the data these models were trained on. So you can't just like drop in one of these models on a DICOM file or an electrocardiogram raw wave file or a BAM file. Be like, hey, what does this mean? It would be like, I don't know. There's 3 trillion A's and T's and C's and G's in random order. It means like gook. I don't know. It would build the largest 4-letter sentence in the world. I mean, you'd be like, I don't know. So it doesn't know that like that's actually counting, counting base pairs to figure out if a gene is mutated. So I think we have work to do in applying these models, but it doesn't seem to me to make a ton of sense to try to rebuild these models. They're incredibly powerful. There are multiples of them. They're kind of easily accessible. So it seems there's no need to invest money in building a entirely bespoke foundation model. That said, there are certain data types where these models don't work at all. They just weren't designed for that. And so I think we will likely have to build smaller models that are tuned to a specific data element for healthcare. But in general, we apply models from all the big players today, and they are just getting better, you know, by the month.
What do you think is the biggest advance that multimodality will give us that we haven't got yet from a multimodal analysis of using AI over biological data? Like, what's the big unlock? And does that constitute some sort of, maybe it's overused, like a ChatGPT moment in health, or is it something different?
There's really kind of basically a few massive unlocks. I mean, the single biggest unlock is essentially if I look at every outcome or response, okay, there's no reason why at some point, given the size of these models, the increasing scope of these context windows and the ability to run compute at low cost, I won't be able to draw associations between like lots of molecular data and outcome response. So like that's just like literally lights on versus lights off. Like that, which I think companies like Tempus will make real very soon in the next whatever, 1, 2, 3 years, whatever it is, that will be, I think, considered the first true moment of precision medicine. Like the fact that I found an EGFR mutation and gave an EGFR inhibitor, that's kind of targeted medicine. It's targeted, it's kind of cool, right? Targeted. But so is chemotherapy targeted to, you know, this particular chemo is targeted to that disease. True precision medicine is like, I know exactly who Charles is, and he's not going to respond to this drug. Like, that's not going to work. And so that becomes like, whoa, wait a minute. We now need molecular data because that's how we're going to actually determine your individual course of therapy, which will not be the same as Brett or I, even though the three of us may have the same exact disease, phenotypically. So that's like a huge deal. That's going to be, and that will work, I think, equally well in oncology as it will in diabetes and, you know, in cardiovascular disease and neurological disorders. Like, it'll work a lot of places. And then I think the second part of the aha moment here will be, you know, in addition to like molecularly pointing you in the right direction, when we have all these different data modalities being fed in, your pathology slides, your scans, those same models will likely find all kinds of things maybe even in predictive ways, so that we get to you before you develop disease. And that'll be even another kind of aha moment here, where I'm going to, you know, you'll show up and your A1C score is 5.8, but, you know, you were riding your bike and you had a little piece of thing went in your eye and so you had a retinal scan 6 years ago. And I'm looking at that retinal scan and your A1C and three other things. And I run some algorithm in the background. And I'm like, Charles, you're going to develop severe type 2 diabetes in 3 years. And you're like, whoa, okay, so I'm going to stop eating donuts every morning.
One of the things that originally attracted me to the Tempus research was actually the really lovely work you did a few years back with sort of phenotypic embeddings and how do you position, like the deep phenotyping concept, the data-driven. How do you think, though, about, obviously, we're seeing in the natural language space, hallucinations are becoming one of the big issues in the whole thing. And it's somewhere, some places in bio, you could imagine hallucinations being either low impact or tolerable or even encouraged, right? Like in drug discovery in the early stage, as long as you can close the loop and you can get to ground truth and validate, a hallucination might be a kind of another form of scientific creativity. At least, you know, you can tolerate false positives. And then the further and the closer you get to the clinic, whether it's in development and, you know, it becomes more and more expensive and more impactful if, you know, chasing false positives. And then in actual clinical deployment, false positives could be very problematic because even if they can be ruled out, you know, someone might end up on like a diagnostic odyssey or something like that. How do you think about that? Is it more about just identifying those cases where that, you know, where there's tolerance to something like hallucination and then, you know, addressing those? Or is it, do you think that the models just get better and better and hallucinations become less of a problem, those kind of type one false positive errors?
I think the models get better and better. I think hallucinations are already like logarithmically down, you know, I don't even know what percent, you know, from chat one, you know, 1.0 to 4.0 or 0.1 or pick a model. But even beyond that, I don't advocate a system without humans. Okay, so let's get it to here. Autopilot works really well, okay? Like we got, you know, a 777 has auto takeoff, autopilot, and auto land. Like these things have very automated systems. I want two pilots up front. Like I'm not advocating the pilots can like not be on the plane, and I wouldn't advocate a physician is not in the middle. No matter how sophisticated these systems get over the next decade or two, I very much want a doctor being like, yeah, makes sense. I'm going to hit go. And I one day, maybe that's unneeded. Maybe, I don't know, but nowhere in the near horizon. Like if I had a kid going to medical school today, which I don't, but if I did, I would not have any hesitation to say you have great job security throughout your entire career. But yes, 100 years from now, will we need doctors? I don't know, but we certainly will need them for the next, you know, 30, 40, 50.
Yeah. I mean, also the way I think about it is it's kind of like, you know, if you look at kind of like the radiology is an example where even 5 years ago, people were saying, hey, with image classification, what do we need radiologists for? And it's actually, you know, radiologists were spending something like 5 seconds per slide. You know, there was a lot of stuff that actually they would prefer to have a system that can kind of like cleave off those easy cases so they can devote kind of their training to paying more attention to the things that matter more, you know? And I think that that's the, like a lot of times, or my experience with medical professionals, it's like, of course they don't have time to read my entire chart or my mother-in-law's entire chart, which is incredibly complex. And like, they can't actually process all that information in the time and kind of like monetization scheme that they're afforded when they meet with her. So if they had a better like mechanism to embed all that information so it could say, hey, this is what we think is going on, then kind of like their kind of training and learning can be applied in a much more effective way to kind of impact her health outcome positively.
I think the other thing that's kind of interesting, if you look at there's a DeepMind paper from a few years ago on the automated mammography reading, which was very interesting because essentially you can dial in the sensitivity specificity, i.e. sensitivity, as folks will appreciate, being essentially the number of false negatives or a measure of that, and specificity being the lack of false positives. And you could, because you can dial it in to that point about the pairing of the human and the machine is really nice because you know very specifically, because you can run enough tests on the machine, what setting you're at. So you if you had like a paired radiologist, you can have the AI radiologist, if you like, being set very very high detection rate, even if they send over some false positives, and then the human can deal with it, which is, you know, overall you end up with a better system actually, which, and it's way cheaper and faster. So that I think that is just one early little signal. And I think Tempus is really industrializing some of this that, you know, I think leads to dramatically better and cheaper healthcare, which is very exciting. It's, as you say, it's the augmented human.
100%. But when you it's like when you start with a system that, for the sake of argument, is somewhere between 30 and 50% inefficient. Some pick some number, okay? These improvements that you get, like you won't even kind of feel them at the macro level. I mean, here's a great example. Like, I'm 55. So I grew up in a world where there was no smartphones and no GPS. So you basically got lost everywhere you went. You got lost. Literally, if you were driving, you were lost. You were pulling over to a gas station, asking someone like where to go. So, okay, lost on the road is gone now. Like no one's been lost in a decade. Like no one's ever gotten lost unless they don't have a signal. And like, do we use less gas? Are the roads like empty? Like, in other words, that whole inefficiency is gone. Like all the miles we drove in the wrong direction are gone. And yet it's really crowded and gas prices are really high and blah, blah, blah. And so I think it's the same thing here. Like, you know, there's going to be massive efficiencies, but I wouldn't structurally, when we take these leaps to like, what are all the doctors going to do? And, you know, what do we do with a million nurses? Like they will be like, there will be a shortage of nurses a decade from now. I like would guarantee it. So, but hopefully what does happen with technology is you get significant improvements every year so that 5 trillion either stays at 5 trillion, but can handle another 50, 60 million people and can handle them living a lot longer so that it, as a percentage of GDP, it comes way down. Or you get real savings. You know, you get that 5 trillion to 4 trillion and all of a sudden you've got some dislocation, no question, but you've got a system that's way healthier.
I wonder if you could unpack for me there's like this throughout my whole career of looking at like technology and diagnostics, people have asserted that there's no money in diagnostics basically because they become interchangeable. And maybe that narrative has diminished some specifically in oncology where kind of there's the ability to kind of like demonstrate differentiated testing, but it certainly is true in like, you know, standard blood testing and stuff. How do you think about that from kind of like building sustainable businesses within Tempus? And then also is there something different about oncology versus other kind of parts of healthcare that just lend itself to this sort of business model working, and then it'll be just more challenging in other areas?
I think it'll be either the same challenging or probably less challenging in other areas because we'll the roadmap in oncology will likely kind of set the stage for other areas. And oncology had to be first. So there's always, change is always hard. But look, I mean, and you know, the guys that are, you know this pretty well, but I mean, before Tesla, if you just said like, you just said, there's no money in making cars. What a horrible, you know, like the biggest company in the world's worth $25 billion and they've been around for 100 years and, you know, whatever. So I think this notion that, by the way, you'd have kind of said the same thing about movies. You'd have been like, who wants to, like, Blockbuster's not that great. I don't want to, with the world, and here's Netflix worth, I don't know, I have no idea, 20 times what Blockbuster was ever worth or some, probably some number like that. So when a technology paradigm shift can kind of open up entirely new businesses. And I would suspect that if Tempus is ultimately as successful as a Tesla, its journey is going to be very similar, right? Which is like, okay, we made a better car, like we made better diagnostics. And so that produced some growth. But long-term, all these other things you layer on top create really the sustainable advantage. Like, you know, in the case of Tesla, you know, things they're doing in terms of autonomous driving that could one day open up, you know, taxi business or their recharging stations or, you know, robotics, all these things that get layered on top of this core, like I'm going to build a better electronic, you know, mousetrap than the current gasoline-powered mousetraps that exist. And so I think it's opened up the world's idea to like, oh, wait a minute, you can have a trillion-dollar car company. And I suspect the same thing will happen in diagnostics. I would bet a lot of money that you will see diagnostic technology-enabled diagnostic companies that could be very, very big. Because again, they sit at the heart of all major decisions. So why would they kind of give all their, why would they just cede all of that insight to somebody else? Why wouldn't they become the people that deliver that insight? And the fact that some of the diagnostic players historically have been rooted in very low margin, high volume tests is the same as the fact that we had car companies that, you know, didn't become Tesla. Like you just have it, you know, or we had, you know, video store rental companies that didn't become Netflix. Like sometimes you need a new entrant to kind of change the game.
There's also a lot more complexity, right? Diagnostic tests in a good way, because they're just doing more, are becoming more complex, harder to do, therefore also harder to commoditize. And we've seen that in some of the MRD and, you know, in some of the, certainly the early detection work as well. We've got these quite layered tests looking at several different epigenetic signals, et cetera. So
when we decided to acquire Ambrag, you know, people would say to me, like, again, they bring up this, first of all, by the way, when I started Tempest, for the record, the first thing people said to me is, don't open up a lab. NGS is being commoditized. This is a commodity space. This is a race to zero. And all that's happened in the past 10 years is the exact opposite of that. And then when we decided to buy Ambry, people were like, hereditary testing is, that's, you know, it's like, isn't that a commodity? Like, that feels like it's kind of, the best days are behind it. And I'm like, well, how'd you conclude that? And sometimes public investors are like, well, I bought Invitae stock and I bought Mary, didn't work out. Well, that's not a space. Like, that doesn't define a space. Right now in this country, I don't know, some micro percentage of people get, you know, kind of whole genome or whole exome or large panel hereditary testing. And I would suspect if you and I could fast forward 20 years from now, it's like the whole country, maybe 50, 60% of the whole world. So I don't know. I mean, how big could somebody like an Ambry get? Like, you know, giant, you know, literally. I mean, so, and I don't know why that wouldn't happen. We're going to ultimately understand from that molecular data, because of these large language models and other large image models, like everything that's going to happen to you. Oh, like, you know, you're kind of at really high risk of developing AFib at some point down the road, or you're really at high risk of early onset dementia, whatever it is. And you're going to want to know that, and you're going to want to take action. And so, and when you get disease, that same data can be used like over and over again. That's the best part of molecular data. I can just keep reusing it. So for example, what drug are you taking? Like, do you metabolize that drug well? Like, maybe you need double the dose. Maybe you need half the dose. Like, all these insights will flow from molecular data. So I do, one of the reasons we chose to like start with molecular data is we thought there's no way to make diagnostics intelligent if you can't generate molecular data. That would be like Tesla trying to build an electronic vehicle with no battery and no ability to like get a battery, like hoping someone else would give them a battery. And I just think that would be a tricky place to start.
Over the course of like Tempus, the underlying technology, like the technology that's able to power what you're doing has improved. Like we think, you know, in our work, AI systems cost per performance are improving 75% per year, or falling by fourfold per year, as in same dollar out, you get fourfold the power year by year. So much faster than Moore's Law. So you must palpably feel that. And how do you like business plan around that kind of underlying power explosion? Like, how do you think about like even both strategically and then how you're building products? Like, how do you kind of like build on that foundation that's moving so quickly?
Yeah, we palpably feel it, no question. I mean, a bunch of the agents we built that run models today like would have been cost prohibitive. When we started, we started building agents pretty early. Like we were very early in this game. We've been at it for, you know, a few years. So we were early. And some of the models we began running, we'd run a query and it would cost us like $2.7 million to run like a very tiny query. And we're like, okay, this is bad. Like even we who spend a lot of money on cloud and compute can't absorb this. It's like inhuman. And now those same models that cost us $2 million bucks to run now cost I don't know, $2,000 to run. So it's literally, it's like that extreme, or 10,000, or some tiny fraction of what they were. So there's no question we're benefiting from that. But remember to do what, well, not remember, but to do what Tempus wants to do at scale. Our main business eventually is to contextualize all diagnostics and generate real-time insights so everyone's on the right therapeutic path. So to do that, I essentially have to kind of run compute across all healthcare in real time every time there's a diagnostic insight. So that's a layer, like, we're not ready for that. Tempus isn't ready for that. The US healthcare system is not ready, but I think it will be at some point. But you're talking about a scale that's really unimaginable. It's like a different level of scale. And so, we spend a lot of time, we're tri-cloud today, but we spend a lot of time thinking through with our cloud partners, how's that going to work? Because that is going to come. And people like Google and Microsoft and others will have to figure out how to make that possible.
We touched on Olivia for a second, but it'd be interesting, as that was a recent launch, just to talk a bit more about that. And I gather even the naming of that was yet another personal story of how cancer at least come close to you and family. So any insights or just thoughts about that and the roadmap around how you see that developing and helping patients would be super interesting.
It was a personal story. It was a friend of my daughter's who passed away. And, it was a great opportunity to kind of recognize her. But the challenge that her parents had and the challenge that we all have, if you've ever been in this situation, is like managing complex care is miserable. Like if you have multiple doctors that you are trying to get opinions from and weigh in and what should I do and da, 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 it is like no simple task, especially when you have like scans and slides and tests and all that. So, Tempus, if you think about it, like we've spent a couple of $1 billion building these technologies that make sense of multimodal, messy healthcare data. And we thought, look, let's put that into an app and give patients access to those same tools so they can basically kind of click a button and not just get like some of their structured data from, MyCharts or Apple or whatever, but really get all of their data, like literally all of it. So that if you want to move from one doctor to another or get a second opinion or just have an archive of it, like it's there. And you have it stored in this little personal locker that's in your pocket. You can send that data anywhere you want because it's your data. And you can ask it questions. And in theory, as these models get better and better, the questions you'll be able to ask will just keep getting smarter and smarter. And we want patients armed. I've been saying this for a long time. I started telling hospital systems and doctors that, I've been doing this for a while and it felt to me like there was this tsunami coming. Only unlike other tsunamis, this one was like 5,000 feet high, traveling like at the speed of an asteroid. Like this was like really not a fun tsunami and they needed to get ahead of it. And I think that tsunami, I couldn't really articulate what it was 9 or 10 years ago, but now I really feel like I can. That tsunami is that the average patient who today walks into their doctor in a completely uninformed way, looking to just put all their trust in somebody else with no understanding of what's going on, in a really short period of time, will walk in as if they just met with 100 of the smartest people on the planet that spent weeks understanding their condition and have given them the 10 questions they need to ask and make sure they get right. So like you're going to go from like uninformed patients to like super informed. And then you're going to say something and they're going to be like, did that, like, what do you think? It's going to be like, oh, no. Like, no, don't do that. Bad. So, that's going to happen. So at the end of the day, you're going to have really sophisticated tools that patients can use. And we view information flowing to everyone as nothing but a good thing, like period, end of story. I want payers paying for the right drug, not the wrong drug. I want drug companies being as efficient as they can be, never having a failed phase two or phase three. I want patients to know everything about their care. I want good doctors to be great doctors and great doctors to be super doctors. Like, you just want information flowing, and the people that, the only people that should suffer in that world are the people that are like, nah, forget this technology, it's garbage. It hallucinates. I'm not gonna, you know what, it hallucinates, I'm done with it. And if you, and what's crazy, that's just, like, there was a great stat, I can't find it, I wish I could. Someone read an article a while ago, they asked Fortune, like 50 or 400 CEOs back in the year 2000, if they thought the internet was a fad. And then they looked at the stock market cap of those companies stratified by the CEOs that said it's basically a fad versus those that said this is like going to change everything. And it's like, it's perfect. It's like a perfect correlation. Like, those people that saw it coming got ahead of it. Those people that didn't. And we want everyone in healthcare to get ahead of it.
Olivia is available nationwide now, right? Like, I can go and sign up.
Yeah, it's going to take us. We were flooded with people that wanted to come in. We made a decision to give everybody a free it's like, I think it costs like $12 a month or something. So we wanted to give people a 14-day free code because we didn't want everyone just, you know, not trying it. So we've been metering out how fast we get those codes to people and how fast that all works. But everyone will come off the wait list in a day or so. And then as people sign up, let's get the code.
It is striking from the, you know, as a patient and then with people in my family that are patients, the difference just from asking Google what's wrong with me, which, you know, what leads me to WebMD, which leads to me to you might have cancer, to like actually plugging in, you know, diagnostic information readouts to ChatGPT and being like, what is going on here? It's such a profound, likely more useful tool. And so then having that, but the friction there is like, I can only plug in whatever I have can copy out of the EHR into the context window of ChatGPT. And I then have to like kind of like randomly insert other information that like I think is relevant to it. So it seems like having that, like the full patient experience packaged and then fed into an intelligent language model really could change the consumer experience of healthcare. And do you think that, like, in some ways, like the payer system seems so broken, kind of like the healthcare system is broken in part by the fact that the consumer is in some ways divorced from all the decisions that get made. Do you think that what Tempus is doing catalyzes and or requires there to be a more consumer-driven kind of like health decision framework that happens here?
But I couldn't agree more with you that these experiences, and by the way, remember, like for us, Olivia's like chat 1.0, right? And this is like very early, so it'll keep getting better. But what I really believe is if you look at Google for a moment, Google has really two kinds of searches. They have regular search and incognito. And in a world of healthcare, they actually need a third kind of search, which is, you know everything about me. Like literally, you have my entire medical record. And when I ask you a question, Google, I don't want a generic answer. I want you to literally, I want you to be like, I want you to know everything about me and then say things with that in mind so that you're not recommending, if you know I'm taking an antidepressant, don't send me like to something else. Like just, obviously my meds are wrong. You know, whatever it would be. Like, I really want you to render results that are high and not just kind of semi-personalized, but entirely personalized. Like, and I think the challenge is some of the big search engines, and I think also, you know, could be this way with some of the big LLM companies and generative AI companies, is that they may have a hard time with that, right? They're kind of like, well, privacy, and I don't want all that data, and it's a lot of PHI, and what do I do? So I don't know how this is going to shake down. It may be that companies like Tempus end up kind of building more impactful products because we want to have that relationship. Like, we're not afraid of it. To the contrary, we think it's invaluable. But I do think eventually, you know, everyone will have to adapt and allow you to talk to your AI agent in an incredibly, you know, identified way.
Great. Well, thank you, Eric. That was fantastic to hear some of the vision and bringing it back to patients all the time and how technology is helping and will help. What do you think is the biggest, obviously, as they say, making predictions is hard, especially about the future. But as you look like 10 years out, you do a lot of envisioning the future. What do you think is the biggest single thing that will have changed in an individual health journey that is not the case now and will be, you know, hopefully a surprise to the upside? Something that the health system is just not factoring in right now. The markets are not pricing in. People are not thinking about the biggest single thing.
The biggest single thing will be that the error in the current system. The U.S. healthcare system has some amazing attributes, including freedom, right? Freedom to innovate, and blah. But the error the system produces is unbelievable. It's like, I don't know, one of every four decisions is entirely the wrong decision and sets a patient and a system down a really bad road. And I think in roughly 10 years, I could see that being mostly gone, where errors are very infrequent, certainly by 20 years. So somewhere between now and 20 years. And in a world where there's no errors and people never get the wrong drug in the wrong dose at the wrong time, then you're going to have real improvements to longevity. You're going to have probably you could easily see a 3 to 5 year extension of life, something of that magnitude. You're not going to see 10 or 20, but you're going to see, you're going to see 3 to 5. Man, you'll feel 3 to 5. You know, one felt like COVID. It's 1 year. So when we're living 5 years longer, you'll feel it in every part of the economy. It's like no small shift. And so I think that's going to be the biggest change, is people will live longer and healthier lives, because when they have problems, they're going to be on the right path. And then I think, as I mentioned, the next big one that comes after that is being predictive to avoid problems before they occur. It's also coming. And by the way, you worked on that. It's like that space, I think, had some, again, like everything else. Remember, we started sequencing patients 20 years ago. It's only now that maybe we're getting somewhere. And it's probably the same thing in terms of a lot of these early detection and predictive tests. Like the early entrants typically aren't, the solutions change over time and you got to find the right solution. But I think, 10 or 20 years from now, we will be very good at predicting lots of stuff and avoiding it.
I remember we spoke about probably early days of Freenome, early days of Tempus, probably was around 2015, 2016, we got connected. So very excited to see all the progress you've made, and, couldn't be more excited about the future you're bringing for patients. So thank you, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Lefkoski, thank you. And I guess people should try out Olivia if you want better answers about your health. And really, Tempus is, at least all the way going through, reading the S-1 and talking to you leading into the IPO, it really is a company that is approaching things from an interesting and first principles perspective of how to, I think, remake human health ultimately.
And the definition of convergence in health, which we like.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button and make sure to leave a comment down below letting us know what you thought. And if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to the show and follow us at ARK Invest on your favorite social platforms so you stay up to date whenever we drop a new episode.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.